Acts chapter 10 is where we need to start today. Mm-hmm. Acts chapter 10, we'll look at verses 9 through 11. We covered most of that information last time, but we do want to go back and make a couple of additional points, and then verses 12 through 14, and Acts 10 will certainly be new material for us. This is still in the context of Cornelius and Peter and trying to get the gospel to this man's household. That would be the household of Cornelius. In Acts 10:9, the text says, "Now on the morrow, Cornelius has asked the servants to go and find Peter. Now on the morrow, as they were on their journey and drew nigh to the city, Peter went up about the upon the housetop to pray about the sixth hour. And he became hungry and desired to eat. But while they made ready, he fell into a trance, and he beholdeth the heaven open, and a great vessel descending, as it were a great sheet, let down by four corners upon the earth." And then we'll pick up with verses 12 through 14 in just a bit. Now, I've mentioned to you that as you look at Acts 10, you have a pretty good account of what took place. But Acts chapter 11 also says that we have additional information there. And Acts 11 says you have a description of in order. So it's always important if you have some additional information in Acts 11 to look at that as well. And in this case, we do have some additional material. In Acts chapter 11, verse 6, just across the page, he says, "Upon which," he's in the trance, there in Joppa, Acts 11, verse 5, he sees his vision. There's this vessel that descends as a great sheet. It's like this big bed sheet with four corners. And then in 6 he says, "Upon which, when I had fastened my eyes, I considered, and saw the four-footed beasts of the earth, and wild beasts, and creeping things, and birds of the heaven." In the first part of verse 6, you have some information that is not stated back here in Acts chapter 10. And there are a couple of key words there. The first key word is going to be the verb fastened. He said, "I fastened my eyes on what I was seeing." Well, that's important. That word occurs 14 times in the New Testament. Luke is the author of 12 of those 14 times. And that word often occurs in a context of supernatural events. Well, that's what you have here. Obviously, it's a supernatural event. One source said it captures the seriousness and the single-mindedness of the person involved. So there's some things in life where this is a very serious matter. You're completely focused on it. Your attention is riveted to it. And that's what Peter was saying about this sheet. It captured his attention. He really wanted to understand it. And as it was taking place, this isn't something that his mind was over here and over there and all kinds of places. But he was having that single-minded activity as far as watching what was taking place. And then you have that other verb, which is translated considered, and that described careful observation. So as this is unfolding, he wants to have a good understanding of what's taking place. New material then for us begins in Acts chapter 10, verses 12 through 14. He describes the vision, he says, "Wherein were all manner of four-footed beasts and creeping things of the earth and birds of the heaven. And there came a voice to him, 'Rise, Peter, kill and eat.' But Peter said, 'Not so, Lord, for I have never eaten anything that is common or unclean.'" Now, most in here, I think, are familiar with the fact that if you were an Old Testament Jew prior to the time that Christ gave the New Testament, you would have been very mindful of some food restrictions. There would have been some foods where he would have said, "It might be tasty, it might smell good. I don't want to have anything to do with it," because God has not permitted the Hebrew people to have that food. Now, having said that, let me add this. Was that food intrinsically bad? No. And we know that because of a reference back in the book of Genesis. If you were to go back in Genesis chapter 9 and see what you have in verse 3, the Bible is very clear in this point. God said, "Every moving thing that liveth shall be food for you." Well, think about that. Every living thing that moves shall be food for you. Well, would you say that some of the meat that was prohibited to the Jewish people moved? Well, yeah, it did. So God said prior to the law of Moses, it's okay. But then when you get under the law of Moses, all of a sudden God says, not okay. Based on Genesis 9:3, the problem can't be that it was intrinsically bad. What was the problem? Why did God say the meat is now off limits when it came to the Hebrew people, law of Moses? All right, there was a way to distinguish, multiple ways to distinguish God's people from the heathens, the Gentiles. And this was going to be one of the ways. People do the same thing today. If you are in an airport and you have maybe some young people, or maybe there's another activity, some older people, and they're all associated with the group and they want to distinguish members of their group from everybody else in the airport, what do they do? All right, they wear the T-shirt, and sometimes it's that flashy color. It's the orange, or it's the yellow, or it's the green, or blue, whatever that might be. And oftentimes, it's going to be that especially bright color that stands out. So you know, even if you've never met them, you know who the members of your group are. So we do the same kind of thing. And God wanted his people to be distinct from the world. So he had various rules, and some of them were food rules. Ray?
He also wanted not only the people to be distinct from the world, but to start showing them that he had certain rules that they had to follow.
Sure.
Like we have certain rules today as Christians.
Yeah. If you were going to be in that covenant relationship with God, God said it's kind of like a contract, and there are some items that you need to abide by. But you're exactly right. Now, when Jesus comes onto the scene, he starts laying the groundwork for the idea that we're going to head into a time where not all food will be bad, as far as you can go back and start eating all things. And the big discussion of that is over in Mark chapter 7. I don't know how all translations run to this, but in Mark chapter 7 and verse 19, the Bible says in the ASV, Jesus made all meats clean. And you can check it in some other versions as well, but the ASV is especially clear. When you say that all meats are clean, what's that a way of saying? They're okay. You can eat those kinds of things now. And Jesus in Mark chapter 7 wanted people to realize that defilement comes where? From inside or from outside? Defilement, sin. It comes from the outside. It's not what you put inside the body. You're not going to be defiled there because, once again, Genesis chapter 9 and verse 3. Judy?
The other night we were watching a program where they run and do all kinds of calisthenics, and they had one of the guys offered scorpions for the two men that run the show. Can you imagine eating a scorpion?
Were they alive or not?
No, they were dead.
Oh, they were cooked.
But they were
okay.
Encased in some kind of a sauce or like chocolate or something. I don't know. I wonder if this poison is still there.
I can't comment on that at this time. I don't know. You would think that maybe some of that would cook itself out, or it would be neutralized somehow in the cooking process, or maybe there's something that they actually have. I know that with some creatures, they actually have to take out part of what you would have there as far as a carcass or body to make that safe to eat. And that could be there. But I guess if it's dipped in chocolate, ants, grasshoppers, people will eat a lot of things that they normally might not eat.
There were some insects that God told them that they could eat.
Yeah. Well, I remember Lois Beeson, if you remember her. I can recall one of the stories that she told. They were over in Africa, and it was caterpillar season. And, I mean, the people were very generous, but they just said, and this is a loose paraphrase, but they said, it's caterpillar season, don't expect us to share. You know, they did not want to share their caterpillars, and that was fine by Lois. She just said, hey, you can keep all the caterpillars. But for them, that was a delicacy, and they just thought, it's that time, and we don't get these very often, and we're going to make sure that we eat every single one. So people have had some interesting...
Put a grasshopper in my mouth.
Yeah, well, with chocolate it might be a little better, but anyway, you have that kind of thing, and in our case, as far as Mark 7 and Acts chapter 10, Acts chapter 11, it was not that the food was inherently bad. And Peter surely knew what Jesus had taught back in Mark chapter 7, but it's like some other things. Teresa was asking me about this the other day when she was doing some reading in John chapter 3. You have the Lord doing some preliminary teaching. You think about John 3 and Nicodemus. Jesus said you got to be born anew. Well, it was going to be a while before the kingdom was going to be established. Jesus said it's close, but you can't do what's required to enter the kingdom until the kingdom is established, right? I mean, it's like, you know, you can't buy the hamburger until the hamburger shop has been established. And I said that there are some other examples of that as well. Jesus said in Matthew chapter 18, go tell it to the church. Remember, if your brother sins against you, well, you couldn't do it at the time, but that was preliminary teaching. He was setting things up so when the church was established, that teaching would be there and intact and the people would be able to use it. So we have, going back to Acts chapter 10, 12 through 14, we have a threefold command here. Number one, Peter is told to rise, get up. He's told to kill, and then he's told to eat. And the creatures, as you look at the general description for what was on the sheet, I think the assumption has to be that there were both clean and unclean creatures there. And you have a list of those back in Leviticus 11, as well as Deuteronomy chapter 14. When you look at that word which is translated rise, that may indicate that Peter had been kneeling for the prayer, and now it was time for him to get up and to take action. So John, over there, Revelation 1 and verse 17, also seems to have assumed a prostrate position for prayer, or that communication that he had with God, and that may have been true for Peter as well. Peter's hungry, and God gives him the chance to eat some things. I think that this probably was going to be a little bit different than maybe the scorpion deal, that the food would not have been prepared here. This food is going to be jumping on the sheet, so to speak. But Peter was a fisherman, and maybe there was at least something that he could have slain and eaten, but he says, what? Yes or no?
No.
No. And not only does he say no, he says something else. He says, I have never. For the Jews, this was a big deal. For Peter, he was able to look back over his life, and at least to the best of his knowledge, he had not eaten anything that he believed to be unclean by God. The voice that Peter heard in verse 13, that voice, Peter identifies it as the Lord, and that very well could have been the voice of Jesus. I don't know that we can prove that one way or the other, but I do think it's interesting to consider, would Peter have been familiar with Jesus' voice? Yeah. So if there's this voice speaking, it's entirely possible that he recognizes the voice of Jesus. Now, I don't know that we can, again, prove that in eternity the Lord's voice will be what it was on earth. But anyway, he did refer to the voice as Lord. So it very well could have been Jesus. We know back there in Acts chapter 9 and verse 5, as we think about Saul, remember across the page going the other way? And he said, who art thou, Lord? And he said, I'm Jesus, whom thou persecutest. So Saul recognized a voice, recognized that it should be respected, uses the word Lord, and Jesus makes it clear that he is the person who is behind the voice. When you look at Peter's refusal, as far as the original text, it's not quite as harsh as it sounds. You have, I think, a similar thing. Remember, Jesus, after the resurrection, he meets up with Mary and refers to her as, you know, woman. A lot of people have said that sounds harsh, and it does in English, but sometimes the original text does not sound nearly as harsh. And that's, Peter still said no. There's no way to deny that. But still, it's not the disrespectful kind of no that people might use today. The statement about him not eating anything that was common or unclean is also found in Acts chapter 11, verses 7 and 8. And we talked about the reason why the foods were disallowed by God. It wasn't that they tasted bad, necessarily. It wasn't necessarily that they made the people squeamish. Now, sometimes, going back to the illustration that Judy offered, there are some foods which make us squeamish. I have never eaten snake. Maybe one day I'll get a little braver and try that, but that, to me, is just not anything that I have a hankering to try. And some people like alligator or crocodile. I've never tried those meats either, and maybe one day I'll go ahead and try a little sample, but, Teresa says it's good. Go ahead, here's a sample. But as far as right now, those things are just not eel. Those kinds of things just really don't have a great appeal to me. When you think about this food barrier, when God gives this information to Peter, if Peter can start processing this, and he finally does line everything up in the correct way, but if Peter can start processing this, that, oh, hey, all that food back there in Leviticus 11, all the food back there in the book of Deuteronomy, it's now okay to eat, what other light bulb is probably going to dawn on him? Remember, the food was designed to do what? It was designed to say, if you are a Jew, the food is one marker that you are separate from these other people. But now, if you can start eating all this food that the Gentiles eat, then that's a pretty good clue or indication that these guys are on the same level as you. So it was going to be a big deal to come to the conclusion that you could now eat that food, and maybe some of the Jews had an interest in that, some things like pork. But when they finally began to realize that Moses' law was no longer binding, and they had to know that on one level. You know, they're not going to the temple to hand over an animal to the high priest. They understand that Jesus is the sacrifice. They understand that they are no longer worshiping on the Sabbath day. So there were clearly some things that they associated with the New Testament, and they were able to say, okay, the Old Testament, that is in the past. But it's like today, people, anybody ever, when it comes, well, we had one of the county roads that we use, and Teresa and I had this happen about, two or three weeks ago, and we probably weren't the only ones, but you get accustomed to going to maybe services in a certain way or work in a certain way, and they close off one of the roads, and you, as you're headed down there, and maybe you're a little stretched for time, you make that turn, and then all of a sudden, after you make the turn, you're thinking, well, that's not going to work out too well. We're going to have to make a U-turn and go back. So we had that experience. Old habits are tough to break. And even if you know that the road has been closed, even if you know that that food is now acceptable, it is still difficult sometimes to go back and to unlearn or break an old habit. And if you'd grown up as a Jew, that this is food that you just don't eat, we can understand Peter's reaction three times when he gets this heavenly voice, this heavenly vision, and he's told to eat, and he is not willing to do that. Then you also have this. In the next chapter, Acts chapter 11 and verse 3, Ray, if you threw up hand, we'll take that in a second. But you have these people, as this information as far as what happened with Cornelius, they're saying, thou didst go in and you ate with them. So that sounds like, unless that's figurative, unless that means you simply ate in the sense of you had fellowship with them, you were willing to go in and talk with them and communicate and teach, and that's a possible interpretation. But it's also possible that Peter actually ate with the Gentiles. That's interesting. And if he did do that, do you think that he might have been eating some food that would have been no-no food under the law? I think that's entirely possible. So if Peter did that, that really speaks well for him. But at least this is the charge against him in Acts chapter 11. You went in and you ate food with these guys. Now, again, maybe figurative, maybe not, right?
I was just going to bring that point up. They would have been eating the same kind of food as the Gentile from that point on. He'd never ate some of that kind of food before.
Yeah.
So one might be very interesting to him, but there was unclean animals in there and clean animals.
Yeah. If he's staying, I mean, he's hungry and wants to eat in Acts chapter 10, so he does have an appetite. So if he's going to go to Cornelius' house and spend at least a little time there, you'd think that he's going to be in town long enough at that guy's house to get at least a little food, and maybe they would have made some accommodations for Peter. Maybe they would have asked, or maybe they would have said, this is what we've got in the cupboard, and you're welcome to it. So I do think it's entirely possible that when Peter goes to the household of Cornelius, he gets some shocks, one of which was, I'm finally tasting food that, if he's now maybe around 40 years old, we can't say exactly how old he is, maybe closer to 50, maybe half a century, he'd not had any of that food, but now for the first time, he's eating that. And hopefully he liked it.
Is there any place in the Bible that says how big that sheep was? Were they the animals? Were they like, I mean, the size that we see them now? Or were they just little?
It's hard to tell. Judy, when we think about things, especially with a computer, we think about some of the graphics that we see, for example, some of the GIFs, and we know that we can shrink things down as far as some of our electronic technology, and we can still tell if it's an animal, that it's still a sheep, it's still a cow, those kinds of things. It doesn't have to be, a 700-pound cow for us to realize that it's a cow. So exactly how large they were in the vision, I don't know. But I do think it's safe to say that they were identifiable, because you have the categories listed there, and Peter was at least able to see that. So however large they were or small they were, that's about as far as I could go with that to say that they could be identified. Betty?
Is there any connection to the fact that it was done three times, connecting with the fact that Christ told Peter three times to care for the sheep?
Yeah, I think when you think about three times, three strikes and you're out, threefold cord, back in the book of Ecclesiastes, is not quickly broken. When you think about three, that just seems to be a number for completeness in some respects, and God doing this once, if that had been done with the sheep, you might be thinking, well, okay, he just didn't have time enough to process it. After the second time, you're thinking, okay, you should be headed in the right direction. But after three times, like I say, that third time, it seems like we've given you sufficient opportunity. And unless there's a reason to go to a fourth time, the third time was sufficient. And that's the thing that I see there as far as sufficient. And you could relate that back to, Peter's denials. After three times, that was sufficient. And feeding the sheep in the book of John, again, that was sufficient, where Jesus said, feed my lambs, feed my sheep, and so forth. And once he made that point the third time, it was enough. So I think sufficiency there. Carol?
In Galatians, Paul tells that Peter was eating with the Gentiles, and then when the Jews came, he withdrew, and
yeah.
That was his. Yeah.
He took some heat for that. And especially if he went in there and actually ate food, you can imagine, because when people call you on the carpet, it's not a pleasant experience. And if you're a Jew, and you still believe in that aspect of the old law, whether you're a Christian or not, and that was one of the big things. I mean, it was a big, big, big no-no. And it would not have been very difficult for the Jews to have been stirred to the point where they would have been willing to go ahead and create a lot of heat for Peter. Is that it? Betty?
At this time, though, too, the Jews, even though there's been a new law that had come in, the Jews still hadn't been taught that, hey, the Gentiles are going to be coming in.
Yeah.
So they were still thinking, we're still a special people, God's special people. We need to still follow, even though we don't do the sacrifice, we need to follow that we don't eat unclean things and things like that. So, I mean, it's kind of a transition period for them, even though it has been a few years down. It's still a transition period because they haven't really been told that, hey, now the Gentiles are going to be equal with you.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of...
It's very easy for people, yeah, to see Christians as far as classes. In this case, the non-Jews would have been by some seen as sort of second-class Christians. Well, yeah, you can kind of come in the back door, so to speak, but we're the people who were God's special people in the past, and we're the people who still keep some of these rules today. I think you see a similar thing with that when you look at American Christians. It is easy for us to see people in other parts of the world as second-class Christians. Now, before I give you a way that that's done, anybody want to take a stab and suggest how that might be done? It's easy to see other people in the world, if we're looking at it from our perspective, our country, as second-class Christians. Who's going to do the mission activity? Americans. What about the guy who's in the village over in Africa? Does he have a responsibility when it comes to the Great Commission? Sure. But he doesn't have enough money to go 10 miles from home. So we look at him and we're thinking, what good are you as a missionary? Well, in some respects, that might be true as far as not having resources to get 10 miles past his local village limit. Now, from another perspective, he's got just as much a responsibility as we do. However, when we look at our country, our resources, the strength of congregations compared to some other parts of the world, sometimes I think we can say we put more responsibility on us than maybe what should be there. But Jesus did say, the one who has more, he bears greater responsibility. So that's true. But at the same time, there's also that shared responsibility. A couple hands popped up. Carol, I saw you first, and then Ray, and we'll take you, and then maybe one other. Sure.
Then do Christianity the way we do.
That's true too.
And that's really not right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very conceited.
Our traditions, and we do have some when it comes to Christianity, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Some traditions might be meeting under a tree, some others might be meeting in a building, whatever that might be. Sometimes you have missionaries or people who are teaching through the web or mail. They want to Americanize people in other countries. This is how we do it here. This is what we have for a collection plate, so this is what you need. Well, that's simply not true. They might pass a hat, a bucket, or use some other method, but that's a great point.
We had a missionary that come from South Africa to preach in the United States. That was when we lived up in Montana. I've always thought missionaries go over there, but they do have missionaries that come this way.
Yeah, and that strikes us as odd. I can remember a couple missionaries from France. They came to the U.S. And still, to this day, when I think about those guys, they said, well, that's our job, isn't it? Well, yes, I can't disagree with that. And they happened to have the funding, but they decided that they were going to come to America, and this was going to be their mission point, and I think that they probably were able to find some places where they could do some good work. But it's very easy for us to get into that certain mindset, and we are just like the Jews. From a perspective of two. Don, did you have a thought or somebody else? Betty?
You find, now more than in the past few years, but you find now that a lot of the congregations in the United States are willing to send missionaries 3,000 miles, 5,000 miles, or whatever, but yet they're not willing to send them 10 miles down the road.
Yeah, and that's true too, and that's a problem as well. We have our issues. All right, let's take a look at Acts 10, 15, and 16. And a voice came unto him again the second time, what God hath cleansed, make not thou common. And this was done thrice, and straightway the vessel was received up into heaven. Again, the voice is associated with the word Lord. In verse 14, that information was communicated to Peter three times. You also have a record of this in Acts chapter 11, verses 6 through 9. As you look at the information, the three times were not exactly identical with Peter. It does seem like things were changed up a little bit. The first time, Peter is told to rise, to get up, to kill and eat. And the second time, additional information was given, what God has cleansed, make not thou common. But Peter's given three chances to obey the voice. He disobeys each time. and then the vessel is taken back up into heaven. A couple points about that. Number one, somebody pointed out several years ago that the word know is not a bad word. The word Lord is not a bad word until you stick them together. No Lord. Once you join them together like that, that's a problem. We want to be people who respond favorably to God and say yes instead of no. The other thing that might bear some discussion here quickly is some people ask what happened to the animals. Well, if you were looking at this from a purely physical standpoint, I think that would be a great question. But if you're looking at this from the standpoint of a vision, the question doesn't seem to be such a difficult question. What happened to the animals? Well, yeah, but I'm not even sure that we have literal animals. I mean, remember, this is a vision. So could Peter have risen up and killed? I think that God would have done what was necessary for him to have been able to have done that. But again, you have to bear in mind that this is a vision and be careful as far as trying to press that too far. When you take a look at the variety of animals, and you do have a variety, don't you? How's the variety described? Yeah, I mean, you've got the same description back there in the book of Genesis. It seems to cover just about every kind of animal that you can imagine. What would you think if that symbolizes something it represents? Well, sometimes you have a child, for example, or maybe it's you. You're looking for a snack, and you go over to the cabinet. You go over to your snack cabinet, and you've got two or three choices. Well, as you look at your two or three snack choices, maybe you're completely satisfied. But you might have another occasion where you're looking at the two or three snacks and think, that's just not going to cut it tonight. I want a snack, but it's not number one, it's not number two, it's number three. I don't know what choices four, five, and six would be, but chances are one of those three would be a whole lot tastier to me than what I have right here. When you look at what Peter is offering, I think that you have to maybe see some symbolism there as far as completeness. It's not that Peter was able to look at these animals and say, well, there's nothing on the sheet, there's nothing on the menu, so to speak, that appeals to me. It wasn't that. It was just that God says, I'm giving you a full range, and you have rejected the full complement. You've rejected everything that I have offered you. So when you look at that, it was a complete offer by God. It was a complete rejection by Peter. Going back to the question that Betty asked, maybe we can add one more point there. If something happens to you once, you may or may not remember it. Something happens to you twice, once again, you may or may not remember it. But if something happens to you three times, bang, 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 do you think that's probably going to be impressed in your memory? I think there's probably going to be a good chance that you will recall it. So completeness and the repetition there. All right, a couple of things that some people may want to discuss. Don, we'll begin with you.
The animals are sheep. When Jesus the voice told him to rise up, kill, and eat. He said, no. Well, he said, unclean. Were they all unclean animals?
I think you've got a mixture. I think that when you look at the wide range of animals that were there, I think you've got to see this as a mix of clean and unclean animals. And that's part of the reason why Peter is so confused.
He said, well, I'll eat the clean, but I won't eat unclean.
Yeah.
But he only says, no, I won't eat the unclean.
Yeah, but the offer of the unclean is there. To get the vision lined up with what we're talking about. Remember, ultimately, what is God trying to help him understand?
Gentiles.
The Gentiles, remember, that's why I gave that background information before. The animals were designed to separate the Jews and Gentiles. But if you're now going to start ripping that separation down, if you're going to give this sheet to illustrate that, what do you want to have as far as a mixture of animals? If you just show him a bunch of clean animals, that's not going to do anything for him. But if you start mixing in the unclean with the clean, now that's a game changer. So that's why I say you don't have a specific statement which says that the clean were mixed in with the unclean, but when you talk about all manner of four-footed, all sure sounds to me like you have now joined clean with the unclean. And as Peter sees that, that's got to be shocking for him. God says, look, here's the full mixture, clean and unclean. You just rise up and take whatever you want. And Peter says, uh-uh. So that's how I view that, Don, as far as it was just so overwhelming that he would be able to have a full range of options. That it's not just focusing on the clean, but it's kind of like, how can this be possible that I could have either, as far as the Jewish law was concerned, a clean animal or an unclean animal? And he just says, I'm not going to have any part of it. All right, a couple other hands have Come up here, Marshall. We'll take you, and then Ray, and then we'll go to Betty.
This is a question, and I don't know this, but because they were all on the one sheet, is it proximity of the unclean to the clean make the clean unclean? Because do you see what I'm saying?
Okay, are you thinking that there would be today, like you would have a line, and the clean on this side and the unclean on the other?
Well, in the Old Testament, under the Jewish law, were the clean ones contaminated because they were with or in close proximity to the unclean?
Okay, but remember again, Genesis 9:3. All animals were not a problem. But for the Jews, yeah.
For the Jews, did they have to have them separate? Like they couldn't touch a dead body or they would be unclean. If they, because the unclean animals were mixed together with the clean ones, did that make them all unclean?
I'm going to, just without being able to put some specific passages with that right now, I'm going to go in the no category as far as an answer.
I
can stand corrected on that point, but that's the answer that I'm going to give you right now. That just being in the presence would not have necessarily meant.
Okay, I thought maybe that's why he rejected them all.
No, because you're going to have some contact as a Jew. You're going to have some contact with those unclean creatures at various times.
That made them unclean.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the Jews would have argued that having contact with an unclean creature, for example, with an insect, for example. If you could say that there's an unclean insect and the Jews happen to come up as far as... Yeah, I think that's a stretch.
Okay.
All right, let's take Ray and then Betty. He's going to pass for now.
What is the difference? What is he meaning in the difference of common and uncleanness?
Okay, I would look at that in terms of like a Leviticus chapter 11, where God said these are okay for you, these are not. The clean would be okay, the unclean would be not okay.
But he says he had never eaten anything that is common or unclean. So what is the difference in common and unclean here?
Okay.
Eaten anything that is common or unclean?
You know, I didn't check the word common, or if I did, it doesn't stick in the head. I'm going to have to go back and look at that, Betty. But I will check that out, and we'll discuss that next week. But off the top of my head, the Greek for that is not sticking with me. But let me check that. That's a good question.
So when Peter called it common or unclean, and then further down the road, he called the Gentile common and unclean.
Yeah, that may be a word. I like to say, I'm going to look at that before I go out on the limb and start making some guesses. But
so this wasn't really
ultimately, yes. That was the point that God was trying to commit. At least in general. We're going to see as we get it down a little further that he's pondering this. He's trying to go through and process all the different possibilities. And as he's still trying to put things together, these three guys show up at the gate. And the Holy Spirit says, go with them. Don't doubt. So he doesn't have it all figured out, but he's headed down the right road. Carol, and then Steve will take your thought. Okay. It may be, and again, it may be that you're describing the same thing with two different words. I'm just not in my head recalling that. I didn't feel very well yesterday, and my time in the Greek text wasn't as much as I normally spend. So, Steve?
Could be oversimplifying it here, but the I think what is natural is people are resistant to change. I mean, we're resistant to change now. And many generations where the Jews and Gentiles were separated, and even and that was set forth by God, and then God's changing it, and so he's the one, and yet they're thinking, well, I don't know if we want to make this change. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why I think that's part of it. They're resistant to
it is.
Change. They're just used to that tradition. They liked it, or they accepted it anyways. And
yeah.
Why change it now?
Yeah. Think about it in terms of our educational system. If you look at what the kids are receiving now as far as information on how to do math and some other things, it's kind of like, well, the old way was good enough for us. I mean, we were taught these subjects and we were taught how to do math in this way, and this subject was dealt with in this way, or we covered this information. And you find that as the generations go by, when people who were in school several years ago see what's being done by the generations, again, it's resistance to change. Now, maybe some of the changes are not good. That could be true. But if changes are for the better, still, people look at them and they fight them because we are resistant to change. The other thing that we may want to include here before we look at verses 17 through 20 is the information from 1 Timothy chapter 4. Paul talked about the Holy Spirit. He said in 1 Timothy 4 and verse 1, the Spirit said expressly or clearly, explicitly, that there were going to be some people who would fall away from the faith. They would give heed to seducing spirits, to the doctrines of demons. Talked about in verse 2, the hypocrisy of men that speak lies, branded in their own conscience as with a hot iron. Verse 3, he says they're going to forbid marriage. And then he says, also in the third verse, they're going to command to abstain from meats, which God created to be received with thanksgiving by them that believe and know the truth. If that wasn't enough, in verse 4, he says, for every creature of God is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it be received with thanksgiving and prayer. So we might not like the scorpions or the grasshoppers, but Paul said all food is fine under the New Testament system. But like I say, Peter and some of the Jews, they struggled for a little while to come to that conclusion.
There were some unclean animals long before the Jews came about. Back in the time of the flood, they were supposed to take clean animals and unclean animals on the flood. So there would have been like common animals, animals that were all around you. They may have been okay to eat during that time, but they weren't okay to count as holy.
Yeah, and we still, even in our culture, we look at certain foods. For example, I'm not going to go through the list here. Somebody might have this planned for lunch. But we, for example, have some water-based food where we might look at a particular fish and say it's a bottom feeder. And when we talk about that, we're not talking about it in a favorable way. We're talking about it basically scoops up what it can get, and it's kind of like a garbage eater. So there are some animals where as we think about them, even for us, we don't put them in the most favorable light, even though we may say that they're perfectly fine to eat, and maybe we like that particular food. But still, when you look at how they're fed, for us, that's something that sometimes makes people a little uncomfortable. Okay, let's take a look at what we've got in Acts chapter 10, 17 to 20. And this goes back to what Don was talking about a minute ago. Now, while Peter was much perplexed in himself, what the vision which he had seen might mean, behold, the men that were sent by Cornelius, having made inquiry for Simon's house, stood before the gate, and called and asked whether Simon, who was surnamed Peter, were lodging there. And while Peter thought on the vision, the Spirit said unto him, behold, three men seek thee, but arise and get thee down, and go with them, nothing doubting, for I have sent them. A key word in verse 17 is perplexed in the ASV. If you have the King James translation, you might have that rendered as doubt. That verb is expressed with the imperfect tense. It describes Peter. He's in this ongoing state. Vine described that as consternation to the point of despair. It's also a word that you find over in Luke chapter 9 and verse 7. It describes there Herod, I believe that was Herod the Tetrarch. He's thinking about John the Baptist and, you know, Jesus and what's going on there. In Luke chapter 24 and verse 4, Acts 2 and verse 12, Acts chapter 5 and verse 24. We've seen this word again back there in Acts chapter 2 and verse 12, for example. On the day of Pentecost, you have the people coming together and they're confused. The word, this verb, which, again, doubt or perplexed in the ESV, King James, you have it describing a person who goes through all the possibilities. They're looking for a solution. And after they've gone through all possible solutions, what do they have at the end? No answers. They simply do not have the right solution. And that happens to us sometimes. Maybe you feel like that if you've gone through the toolbox or you've gone through the kitchen utensil drawer. You're looking for something, and after you've searched and searched, you don't have what you need. That's what's being described here. Who threw up a hand for that? Steve?
New King James uses the word wondered.
Okay. Again, that's going to point you in the right direction, maybe not quite far enough to bring out all those nuances. You're trying to think about this and figure it out, and you are very, very perplexed. Well, going back to what we said earlier, Acts chapter 11 and verse 6, remember Peter's thinking about this very carefully. He's focused on it, trying to understand it. He's wondering about it. Now, that's in contrast to Cornelius, isn't it? How confused was Cornelius with his vision? No. I mean, all right, angel shows up and says, hey, your prayers, your alms have been heard, and you need to send for this guy named Peter, and he's going to come over, and he's going to have a Bible study with you. You're going to hear words from him. So that's pretty straightforward for him. But Peter is in, and you would think that with an apostle it would have been handled differently, but he gets this information, and he is very, very confused. All right, Peter continues to think about the vision as we see from Acts chapter 10 and verse 19. This word is used in some of our manuscripts, but not all of our manuscripts. And depending on which word you use there in verse 19, you still come out with kind of the similar idea. But one of the words that's used has a dual prefix. And when you add a prefix to a word, oftentimes that will intensify a word, sometimes in English and certainly in Greek as well. But here you have not just one prefix, you actually have a double prefix. So as you look at that double prefix, again, you're coming back to this idea. He's thinking this through and through. He's rolling this around in his mind, trying to understand exactly what's going on. And in spite of all that mental effort, he simply cannot understand what is taking place. This vision has been very, very confusing to him. And we can understand that as well. You've got this sheet, and there are these different animals. You're told to rise, kill, and eat. And you're thinking, at least some of those creatures, I have never been willing to eat those in the past, and what is going on? Well, as Peter is trying to figure out this message, what's true for the servants of Cornelius?
They get there.
Isn't that interesting? We saw that in Acts chapter 8, too. Remember we talked about the marvelous timing? You had this fellow in Acts chapter 8, the Ethiopian eunuch, he's reading, and he's at the right passage of Scripture, and the preacher shows up at just the right moment. Well, this is also what we find in Acts chapter 10. When you look at this, you find that the three men want to know if Peter is there. That's Acts chapter 10 and verse 18. Peter's working on the vision at that time, and the Holy Spirit tells Peter, you need to go to the door. I, the Holy Spirit, have sent them, and Peter should have no doubts. That same expression as far as no doubts is found again in the next chapter. This is going to be Acts chapter 11 and verse 12, and there it may be translated no distinction. Whether it's rendered no distinction or no doubts, the idea is really the same. Point number one would be when it comes to having any doubts about Jews and Gentiles now being on the same plane, don't doubt that. It's no longer right to discriminate against the Gentiles. You also might have involved with that, don't waver, don't hesitate. And I think that's kind of an interesting point. When you see Peter as far as his nature, and this could have been true for the other apostles, but could you see Peter as far as his personality, wavering sometimes in some of the decisions that came up? I think that's pretty easy to see with Peter. I mean, sometimes it just jumped, but maybe some other times it's kind of, yeah, I'll go, no, I won't. But in this particular case, the Holy Spirit was aware of that, and the Holy Spirit says, don't doubt, don't worry about going. I've sent these fellas, and these guys need to make sure that you go back with them. If you do look at that from the perspective of doubt, what does that tell you about the apostles? Were they able to doubt sometimes? Yeah. So when you think about being an apostle, you think about all the miraculous abilities that they had. Still, that did not prevent them from some of the human emotions that we sometimes, and the frailties that we have and sometimes have to battle with. And I think that's kind of an interesting point about Peter. Anything that you want to add or ask in the last minute or two that we've got? Okay, let's take a look. We'll at least read Acts chapter 10, 21 and 22. Peter goes down to the men and says, behold, I am he whom ye seek. What is the cause wherefore ye are come? And they said, Cornelius, a centurion, a righteous man, and one that feareth God and well reported of by all the nation of the Jews, was warned of God by a holy angel to send for thee and to hear words from thee. When he says Cornelius was thought highly of by the Jews, how does he describe that? How many Jews thought highly of Cornelius? All the nation. Now, would you say that that's literally true? Probably not. We have an example of what we talked about a few weeks ago. Remember the figurative speech? What kind of figurative speech do you have here? Everybody says great things about him. That's a hyperbole. It's an exaggeration from us. There were probably at least a couple people that didn't think highly of him. But again, for the most part, the Jews, as they looked at Cornelius, they had many, many good things to say about him. He was highly regarded.